When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am excited to have back with me today via Skype Dr. Jacqueline Galvin, who, as you probably remember from our fantastic debate we had last time, is an assistant professor of anesthesia at the University of Illinois at Chicago and is the fellowship director of obstetric anesthesiology there. Jacqueline, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
So we today are going to do another OB podcast, of course, your area of specialty, and we're going to talk about labor analgesia. This is something that is tested very frequently on in-training exams and board exams, and I think will be really high yield, so I'm looking forward to it. Hey, folks, it's Jed Wolpaw here. Just going to jump in and say that now that we've done the podcast, I'm coming back, and I'm going to apologize up front because some of the audio cut out a little bit. We didn't have the best connection. I've tried to summarize every time we cut out so that you didn't miss what Jacqueline was saying, but I think we really did capture a lot of great stuff, and most of it is fine. You'll see there's just some sections where she cuts out a little bit. I think you'll get the important part of what she's saying, and in any sections where it was pretty hard to catch, I have gone back and summarized. Next time we do one via Skype, we'll make sure we have a better connection. All right, let's get back to the show. Jacqueline, let's start off with really basic. When we talk about labor analgesia, of course, that means we're treating pain. So where is the pain that we're treating in laboring women, and how do we think about it?
Exactly. Great. So you can think of it, divide it into the first stage and the second stage. So the first stage of labor is when the uterus begins to contract regularly and the cervix makes change all the way until 10 centimeters of dilation. So this pain is typically described as visceral in nature, arising from the lower uterine segment and the cervix, in terms of spinal cord origins from T10 to L1, and it's generally a diffuse pain, sort of ill-defined in terms of an exact location. The second stage of labor combines not only pain from the first stage, but also the somatic pain of the fetus descending into the vaginal canal and then eventually out of the vaginal canal. This involves deformation of the perineal tissues and the vagina, and that pain not only includes T10 to L1 with the first stage, but all the way through S4, including the pudendal nerves. And this pain can also have referred pain to the thighs, the legs, the buttocks, and the back. So two distinct sort of different origins where this pain is coming from.
Great. All right. And then just to orient everyone. So as you said, the first stage of labor is from the onset of labor until a woman is 10 centimeters dilated, the cervix
That's
is 10
correct.
Centimeters. And then the second stage is from that moment on until the baby is born. Is that right?
That is correct.
And then the third stage is until the placenta is delivered.
Exactly.
Okay. So good. Now we're oriented. Great. All right. So we've got the first and the second stage. And
yes.
So what is it that actually, are there things that influence, kind of how much pain? Obviously, different women have different levels of pain. I think we can all agree this is something that's, those of us who aren't women who have observed it have seen as being very painful. But are there some, things that influence how painful it is?
Exactly. So it's not enough just to think about book definitions, anatomic locations, but also what factors into how much pain women will be having. So some physical factors include things like maternal age. So unfortunately, advanced maternal age may lean to more pain during labor, parity. So obviously, the more babies you've had, it might be an easier time to deliver said fetus. So that may contribute to less pain. Or on the converse end, younger nulliparous, the women who have not had babies before, tend to have more longer and painful deliveries. Also, it depends on how the cervix is. Well, the cervix is light at the beginning of labor. If it's edematous or still very thick, that they contribute to an increased amount of pain during labor. Of course, the size and position of the fetus. So big babies, babies that are occipit posterior, are more likely to cause more pain to the mom. And there is a phenomenon such where a woman has labor dystocia, so they have greater pain, greater difficulties during the labor process, that these women are probably more likely to go on to cesarean delivery. In fact, some studies suggest that the more often you have to top up epidurals during labor, which we'll talk about later, may be a harbinger of women who may need C-sections towards the end of their labor process.
Now, when you say occiput posterior, that is kind of upside down in kind of lay terms, right?
Upside down, right? Yeah. So the back of the baby's head is rubbing against the mom's sacral bone.
Okay.
Sacrum.
And it's the kind of opposite of the way that we think Mother Nature intended, and therefore makes it harder. And if it's harder to push the baby out, there's likely to be more pain.
Exactly. And then moving on from there, so not only are these physical factors, but also some psychological factors. So different things that influence the pain experience. So the person's cultural background, their baseline fear, apprehension, presence or absence of birthing members can contribute or exacerbate or lessen the pain experience. So, for example, in the OB literature, there is this phenomenon of a pain catastrophizing, which is generally described as this sort of maladaptive response to coping mechanisms for labor pain. And studies that looked at this suggested that patients who are prone to this pain catastrophizing have different levels of anxiety, confidence in their ability to go through the labor process can negatively potentially affect their labor process and lead to different responses to their analgesia. And additionally, this phenomenon of pain catastrophizing, again, can be associated with fear of displacing the epidural itself or pressure from others to receive labor analgesia. So it's just another confounding factor that one just wants to consider when they're discussing pain management options with patients during the labor process.
Okay. And now is there, if you kind of identify when you're meeting with a woman early in labor or maybe even, you know, pre-labor, that some of these factors may be present, is there anything that we
can
do?
There's
about
a couple of, that's a good question. So in terms of identifying, there are a couple of questionnaires or surveys out there that could potentially be useful, but again, none are like strictly validated pregnant patients per se. And then what can we do about it? I think we can get into that later, but essentially a good place to start is really good expectation setting right up front, and what are the reasonable expectations of whatever labor analgesic modality they ultimately pick.
Okay, great. So what is the, you know, I hate to say why do we care, because obviously we don't want our patients to be in pain.
Sure.
But above and beyond, you know, comfort for the mother, are there other impacts of labor pain or are there other effects of labor pain on the course of labor or on the fetus itself?
Yes. So three main physiologic points I want to point out, and then that'll analgesia. In the respiratory system, as you can imagine, when the patient is laboring, the noxious stimulation of uterus contraction is a strong respiratory stimulant. So the mom hyperventilates during the contraction period, increased minimum ventilation and increased O2 consumption, which is generally well tolerated in otherwise healthy mom and healthy pregnancy. But also in between these heavy breathing during contractions, and there's compensatory periods of hypoventilation, which can be exacerbated by systemic opioids or other things. In the cardiovascular system, obviously the heart has to deal with all the auto transfusion of blood in between contractions, which also increases cardiac work, which again is tolerated in otherwise healthy pregnancies. Also, epinephrine and norepinephrine are profound increase during labor. And epinephrine in particular is a tocolytic, meaning it causes the
process of delivering, which can lead to dysfunctional labor.
You're cutting out a little bit, but let me just
So
you get an increase in epinephrine and norepinephrine, and I think you said norepinephrine increases by somewhere in the 200 to 600% range during labor.
That is correct. So they both increase dramatically during labor. And this can lead to a dysfunctional labor pattern, which may be able to be ameliorated or resolved with an adequate analgesic plan. Lastly, not being able to treat this pain and this sympathetic overload appropriately may lead to some things that interfere with mother and baby bonding immediately post delivery, postpartum depression, or PTSD. So it's an important reason to try to help these moms have really great pain relief. The placental unit, during the uterine contraction, there's periods of decreased blood flow to the placenta, which may be poorly tolerated in certain high-risk pregnancies like preeclampsia, diabetes, IUGR, which again, appropriate analgesic option may help improve outcomes for these particular pregnancies.
Okay, that's great. Now, is that because when we think about the uterine contraction causing decreased blood flow, obviously with good analgesia, you'll still have the contractions, but is there some reason why there's still better blood flow, or why do we think that that plays a role there?
So one of the theories is that augmenting this really high catecholamine surge that is normally present during will allow for the uterus to properly contract, since those catecholamines are tocolytics. And when the uterus can properly contract, the mom can have a reasonable respiratory cardiac physiology during. It may allow better blood flow overall to the placenta on the baby.
Okay, sounds good. So what do we do to try to prevent this pain?
So this approach is trying to identify what your goals are when you're going to provide labor analgesia. So clearly we want to relieve the sensory pain. But other things we want to do is, aside from relieving pain, also preserve motor function to facilitate the second and the third stage of labor. But we also want to have a reasonable discussion with our patients and our providers, by that I mean obstetricians, what is possible or not possible, again, with the labor analgesic, that is best for the patient in the overall scenario.
Okay, so sorry, Jackie, so you just cut out a little bit, but let me, so basically we want to balance the two goals of both relieving pain but also preserving motor function, so that's always a little tricky. And then also I think the last thing you were saying was educating the patient about what is and what is not possible to set realistic expectations. Is that right?
That is correct, yeah.
Okay, great. So what do, you know, one thing that you know, can certainly be used and that we use for non-labor pain a lot are opiates, of course. So maybe we should start there. What do we use opiates for labor pain? And if so, how do you think about them?
Great. So in terms of the role of opioids, so in the U.S., they don't have a profound role, but there is a role still in especially low-resource countries. Unfortunately, they're not studied vigorously because there are significant maternal anesthesia, a better alternative, that being neuraxial anesthesia. The analgesia is incomplete at best most often, and the side effects are really dose and timing related, which we'll get into when we talk about nummifentanil. But for example, for the mom, there's often nausea, vomiting, sedation, gastric emptying issues. And for the baby, we have to remember that opioids do cross the placenta. They can cause in utero and neonatal depression and possibly decrease variability on external monitoring, which may influence decision-making on part of the obstetrician.
Okay, great. So, again, the one part that cut out a little bit there, so you were saying that in addition to that they can help with labor pain, but there are these side effects combined with what many people would say is a better alternative and therefore makes it something we don't use quite as much.
Yes.
Okay, great. So you mentioned remifentanil. Remind me, what is remifentanil and what role does it have in all of this?
Great. So remifentanil is a quick-on, quick-off opioid. It's used during labor is actually considered off-label, so that does need to be taken into consideration. So as I mentioned, quick on, quick off because of its metabolism by plasma cholinesterases. It does cross the placenta, like we mentioned, for all opioids, and it has a variable plasma concentration in the mom, which is due to different physiologic changes in the mom's blood volume, plasma levels, protein distribution, volume of distribution, things like that. So in terms of how well does it work as a sole and a sole analgesic, it works okay. Some of the studies do report a modest reduction in pain score when it's used early in labor, but pain scores do tend to trend back up as labor progresses. There's also a issue with timing. So, for example, if the mom presses her Remi PCA pin at the top of her contraction, they might not feel the analgesic effects until maybe the next contraction. So if the timing and dosing interval is off, the mom won't actually get the analgesic she's expecting.
Right.
And also, of course, there's limited
I was just saying, yeah, that is my experience. When I have seen these used, that is the big drawback is that, and I think what you were saying, is that women may push the button. So this is a remifentanil in a PCA, patient-controlled analgesia form. So they can give themselves a dose. And if they wait until the contraction starts and then push the button, by the time it kicks in, the contraction may be over or almost over.
That is correct, which certainly can be overcome with patients. It involves a lot of buy-in for the patient and the provider as well.
And we lost you there, Jackie. You were saying it certainly can be overcome by what?
Sorry, overcome by education and buy-in from not only the patient, but of course the provider, and having a lot of patience and understanding, you know, between the two.
Right. Great.
So not impossible, but. And then when you look at and compare to other analgesic techniques, so it's unequivocally inferior to Nuraxil, and that is, of course, not just my opinion. That's been shown in studies. Nitrous oxide, but it also might be synergistic in conjunction with nitrous oxide. For example, a study by Varpashi and others, so there was a redundancy in Remi with nitrous from 8 to 3 out of 5 compared to just nitrous by itself. So it may have some added qualities infused with an inhalational agent.
So Jackie, sorry, you cut out a bit there. Let me just summarize. So I think, tell me if I'm right, but you were saying that that remifentanil is definitely inferior to Nuraxial anesthesia, and that's been shown in studies,
correct.
But it's equivocal to nitrous oxide, maybe synergistic with nitrous oxide, and you mentioned a study that showed that nitrous and Remi together had pain scores decrease quite a bit.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, great.
But again, these are small studies in otherwise healthy patients who have the system to support these two, additional labor analgesics.
Right.
So that's important to note.
Great.
If we want to move on really quick to the last two parts about remifentanil. So we look at, is it safe for the mom? Relatively. So there is some side effects like we talked about, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, itching, so on and so forth. But the incidence of respiratory depression for the mom may be anywhere from 15% to 40%, depending on the definition of respiratory depression. And that in comparison to epidural analgesia, there are lower O2 saturations and higher end-tidal CO2 on external monitoring. So again, in some particular patient populations, this might not be safe. And then we look at for the fetus, as we mentioned, it may cause a reduction in beat-to-beat variability, which again may influence obstetrical delivery decision making.
And just that's I think a really I just want to emphasize because I think it's a great point. So, and in case anybody is missing the significance of that, if the Remi, though not causing any lasting harm to the fetus, causes the fetus to, let's make it simple, to sleep and not be responsive when, for example, the obstetricians might be looking at the beat-to-beat variability, which will be less if the fetus is asleep or is narcotized, they might say, oh, this doesn't look good, we need to do a C-section, even though it wasn't actually fetal distress, it was just fetal response to remifentanil.
That is exactly correct.
Okay.
So that needs to be taken into consideration. But in terms of other opioids, it's less harmful than other opioids. And my example is meperidine that has a metabolite half-life in neonates of 60 hours, which is a long time. So it's less harmful than other opioids. So I think to break it down to Remy fentanyl pearls, if you want to call it that, most obstetric anesthesiologists don't consider it a first-line agent for those things that we had mentioned earlier. In terms of dosing, the typical doses for a PCA are 0.25 to maybe 1 microkg with a lockout of 1 to 5 minutes, plus or minus a background infusion. But most importantly, you want to have safety mechanisms in place, which are recommended to be continuous one-on-one care and some sort of apnea or capnography monitoring and continuous pulse oximetry as well.
Yeah, that all makes
sense.
So
not just something you put in someone's room and walk away, essentially.
Absolutely. All right, so that's great. Now, you mentioned the potential synergy between remifentanil and nitrous oxide. So tell me more about nitrous oxide. Is that something that is ever used alone, or is that only used in conjunction with remifentanil?
Yes, it is used alone, and institutions such as Vanderbilt, for example, have a well-established nitrous oxide protocol. But overall, the U.S. is pretty to UK and Australia, where sometimes over 50%
we lost you there for a second.
Will use it.
Back up. No, it's okay.
Sure.
To the nitrous. So you were saying it is used alone. There are some institutions, I think you mentioned Vanderbilt, that use it a fair amount. Actually, at UCSF, where I trained, it was at least an option. It is used alone some places. And then you were saying...
That's correct.
And then what did you say after that?
So I was saying, in comparison to the UK and Australia, they have a very high utilization rate, sometimes more than 50% of their laboring patients. Or in the U.S., overall utilization is still pretty low in comparison to neuraxial anesthetics.
Got it.
Great. The way it works is it's obviously a rapidly inhaled agent that is administered in a 50% mixture that has some NMDA antagonistic properties, which helps ameliorate some pain during labor. So when we look at it as a sole labor analgesic technique, for example, in a study that looked at 5,000 deliveries, they actually found that of those 5,000 deliveries, only 3% of the women, this is a U.S. study, used it. So who's more likely to use it? People that were nulliparous, so women that have not had a baby before, people that are English speaking. Interestingly, of the 3% that used it, 50% of those women initially wanted a natural birth, so did not want a medicated birth. So those might be the people that are more interested in nitrous. These women only, in this particular study, use it only really for 80 minutes, so not an extremely long time. And during that time, there was a reasonable reduction in pain scores. But most interestingly, 63% of the women who use a nitrous ultimately converted to neuraxial anesthesia. And they found that identifiable risk factors of people that would convert from nitrous to a neuraxial were people undergoing induction of labor or augmentation of labor with oxytocin. And they reported some maternal side effects as dizziness, dry mouth, nausea, vomiting.
Okay.
Secondly, ANA published a study just this year that looked at 6,200 deliveries. Of the 6,200, 80% used neuraxial and 20% used nitrous. What they found only a 40% conversion rate from nitrous to neuraxial. They found that of the women that used neuraxial, greater than 90% of the women had high analgesic effectiveness. But there was a pretty overall low analgesic effectiveness reported with nitrous, so less than 50%. However, the interesting part that even though analgesic effectiveness with nitrous was reported as low, that women were by far and away more satisfied with their labor analgesia compared to the neuraxial group. And there are probably a number of reasons for this, including the ability to deliver the nitrous sort of at will. And also, they could walk around, they could eat, some other things. So even though overall it's not super great as a sole analgesic, women were much more satisfied with the overall experience with it.
And do you think there may be a cultural kind of aspect to this in the sense that you mentioned that one of the studies showed that women who came in wanting a natural birth were more likely to use nitrous, and so maybe if they – succeed in avoiding the epidural and only use nitrous, that there's some sort of validation there. Like I did what I wanted. I had a sort of natural birth. I didn't get an epidural. So that may, of course, I'm just making this up. I don't have any data for this, but I wonder if that may contribute to the feeling of satisfaction with those who only use nitrous.
Exactly. I think you're now right on the head that if it's more of these, more women that prefer a more natural labor course or want to have sort of more of a participatory role in their birth plan, that this may be a mode that provides some pain relief, but ultimately lets the women sort of be more in control of their body, of their sensory. They don't have to have Foley's, so there's more that goes into analgesic satisfaction than just pain relief per se. So it's an interesting topic.
Great. All right. So how does it work? I've seen it, but for our listeners, they may be wondering, okay, I've used nitrous in the operating room, but how do you use it on an awake laboring patient?
Exactly. So I will fully disclose that we don't have it at my particular institution, although we're looking into it. But from my understanding, I think the first things first, as we talked about, you have to set up patient expectations with the patient, with the providers, with your nurses, and so on and so forth. You do need to get the tank and a scavenging system to eliminate the nitrous oxide waste from the room and have your environmental people come in and inspect and be able to support the scavenging system and the tanks and whatnot. You do have to remember your relative nitrous contraindications. So if you happen to have a woman with a pneumothorax, not a great idea. But when we get down to your question, so you need a cooperative and capable patient that is able to hold the mask to their face, make a seal, time it with their contractions, and take a slow, deep breath. And ideally, you want to begin in about 30 seconds or so before the onset of the contraction, so the peak of the nitrous effect is the same, the peak of your contraction. And the same thing with the REMI, that the timing is off, the analgesic property is just not going to be where it needs to be. And then lastly, just from a billing perspective, depending on your institution and things like that, you may be able to only bill for just the nitrous or just the epidural. So that needs to be taken into account as well.
Okay. Now, how would a woman know if she's 30 seconds before the onset of a contraction?
I'm going to say, Judd, that probably women know.
Okay.
Especially if you're in a regular contraction pattern, of course, and you're able to time it with that, that will certainly help, which, again, is patients that are probably more successful, women that are sort of in tune with their labor process, very motivated, things like that.
Okay, sounds good. As long as there, in theory, there must be some kind of pre-contraction feeling that at least once things are regular, that women have.
Yes.
Okay. All right. I'll take your word for it. All right.
That could be another podcast.
That sounds good. All right. So good. So that's nitrous. So now maybe should we talk about the what I assume is the most common form, at least in our country, which would be Neuraxial.
Agreed. So. Again, I think this could be its own separate discussion, but I'll just briefly go through four techniques, one being traditional epidural, which is the standard technique where loss resistance is achieved in the epidural space, a catheter is threaded, a test dose is given to determine that the catheter is not in a vein or in the intrathecal space, and then generally the catheter is dosed or loaded with a dilute local anesthetic, and then some sort of maintenance is provided, so either with a continuous infusion modality or program intermittent bolus.
Now, and Jackie, if I'm remembering correctly, you put the death knell to the traditional epidural last time we
talked. That is correct. I'm trying to be objective.
Okay,
right now.
Fair enough.
But it's one of the great advantages. It's you can utilize it to slowly titrate your anesthetic and not have wild hemodynamic swings. And that is still a meaningful use of an epidural, certainly.
Okay.
Second is my all-time favorite, combined spinal epidural, which involves the initial approach to epidural whereby loss resistance in the epidural space. And then a smaller spinal needle is threaded through the epidural space, which then punctures the dura, There should be a return of CSF in the spinal needle, and then you can give a very small injection of either local anesthetic or combination of opioid, which sets up your analgesic rapidly within 5 minutes, and then the catheter is threaded and left behind, and that maintains your labor analgesia.
Great. Now, for listeners who want the specifics of kind of what one might put in terms of doses and in terms of medications, please refer to the debate we had with Dr. Galvin and Dr. Hofkamp, where they actually did give some examples of what they would do. So I don't think we need to go back into those specifics now.
I agree. Two other less utilized, or I'll just say it that way. There's also this concept of dural puncture epidural, where unlike with a full combined spinal epidural where something is given in the intrathecal space, a dural puncture epidural, you just confirm CSF flow via the spinal needle that is through the epidural needle. And then through there, after that, you leave your epidural catheter behind in the epidural space, and you can bolus it up similar to a traditional epidural. And some thought is that it gives you that midline confirmation of the CSE, but without the hemodynamic swings associated with a rapid onset spinal.
Great.
And lastly, if we want about or just touch on spinal for analgesia or continuous spinal, meaning a catheter is left behind in the intrathecal, is a reliable technique, as we discussed, but in the appropriate hands with appropriate sign-out and management plan, because intrathecal space, again, is so unforgiving relative to the epidural space, the doses have to be lowered by at least tenfold. So those require sort of special handling and care, but can achieve the same thing.
Absolutely. Now, you cut out right at the beginning, so what I'm just going to fill in. So what you were referring to with that was a continuous spinal. So you had said, I think, when a catheter is either purposely or inserted into the intrathecal space, or if accidentally a dural puncture is made and the choice is made to thread the epidural catheter into the intrathecal space, you can run that, but you have to reduce the dose by at least a factor of 10. And, of course, as you mentioned, you have to be very careful that no one mistakes this for an epidural and doses it as if it were an epidural.
Exactly. And so I usually, if that happens, our institution, I generally go over with the resident a plan. So what are we going to do for labor maintenance? What are we going to do for breakthrough pain? And what are we going to do if we go to the OR? That way everything is clear in everybody's mind to try to avoid things like high spinal.
Great. So what comes up I've seen on in-training exams and board exams sometimes are alternatives to neuraxial anesthesia and opioids, other kinds of blocks. So are there other blocks that are done, and how do they work?
There are other types of blocks that can be done. First, we'll talk about a bilateral paracervical block. So that block is appropriate to cover visceral pain from the first stage of labor only, and that essentially involves injection of local anesthetic at the lateral aspects of the cervix. It has a benefit is that it doesn't involve any gross motor and sensory block for the mom. However, just keep in mind that it doesn't cover somatic pain for the second stage. And one of the reasons it fell out of favor is because there's potential for injection of these high volumes of local anesthetic into the fetal scalp, which can cause very deleterious effects for the fetus. So for those reasons, it's not widely used as a first line.
Okay, so that was another just type just want to fill in from the beginning. The audio was cutting out for a sec. So the bilateral paracervical block, you said injected at the lateral aspects of the cervix, and that can work for the first stage, but, and this is commonly where those questions come from, is they'll give you some kind of multiple choice question about which will cover which stage of labor. So this would cover the first stage, but not the second stage. And as you said, the potential big side effect is injection into the fetal scalp.
That's correct.
Okay. What's another form of block?
Another block would be a paravertebral lumbar sympathetic block. So it's just what it sounds like. It's basically like a one-sided epidural block, for lack of a better word, but you don't directly inject into the epidural space. And so essentially it covers, again, only the first stage of labor. There's less motor block and things like this for the mom, and those side effects of fetal bradycardia. But the big disadvantages is, one, it's not a continuous labor analgesic modality. So it's really only done one time, is discontinuous. It does involve bilateral injections to get coverage for the right and left side of the mom. It's technically more challenging to perform, and it doesn't also cover the second stage as well.
Okay, great. So those two are both for the first stage. And then is there anything that you can do that would help with the second stage?
Yes. For the second stage, one could perform a pudendal nerve block, which does cover vaginal, vulvar, and the perineal area. It's appropriate for a low forceps delivery. That space can be accessed transvaginally or transperineal in the appropriate hands. However, the bilateral success rate is pretty low to get both sides covered pretty well. And there's also, as we mentioned, possible injection to the fetus and injury. This block is generally done really late in the first stage, or maybe as the second stage is approaching. So one just has to be careful not to inadvertently injure the fetus.
Okay, great. Now, do you guys do any of these blocks, or are these pretty obsolete at this point?
Sure. We do not at our institution. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, fair enough. I've never seen any of these done.
Okay.
Except for the
me neither.
The paravertebral I have seen, not for labor, but I've seen it
Correct.
Done for other things. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that done for like mastectomies,
exactly.
things like that, but I have not seen it for labor per se. And I personally don't perform any of those.
Great. Fair enough. All right. So are there, when we think about labor analgesia, are there important potential complications we should think about?
Absolutely. So there are several, but just touch base on a few. One should always keep their eye out for high spinal, which is inadvertently mistaking the epidural catheter and not recognizing that it's intrathecal. As we discussed, these medications can cause high levels to rise. It can impede the respiratory drive for the mom who moms already have impaired residual volume, things like that, FRC, is what I was trying to say. So moms have cannot tolerate a period of apnea very well. So high spinal can cause respiratory problems for mom, breathing problems can precede an imminent delivery. So you always want to keep high vigilance for that, that complication.
Okay.
Local anesthetic toxicity, luckily, is pretty rare in the pregnant population. But again, because moms have a low, cannot tolerate periods of hypoventilation or periods of decreased cardiac output very well, given aortocaval compression
yeah.
and things like this, when a mom does have local anesthetic toxicity, one needs to be ready to treat it with intralipid
So we lost you there right at the end. So you were saying if we do see local anesthetic systemic toxicity, that we obviously want to be ready to treat it right away, and that the most important treatment would be intralipid. Though obviously if it proceeded to a code, you would do all of the other ACLS things that you would normally do, but also really, really important if you suspect local anesthetic toxicity to get and give intralipid.
One other complication is when your block doesn't work like it's supposed to. And in this scenario, you don't want to fool yourself that your block is working when it's not. Because one of the main safety mechanisms of having a well-working labor epidural is the ability to convert it to a surgical epidural and avoid the morbidity of general anesthesia in a pregnant woman for a cesarean delivery. So one might take the approach of doing a full evaluation of your block, pain scores, motor block, looking where your catheter is secured at the back, finding out what's going on with the mom during labor, doing an appropriate intervention, and certainly if that intervention doesn't seem to be working, to consider replacing the epidural if you don't think it's working. And with a replacement, do this as a change as you can, such as the provider, the level, the technique, things like this.
Okay, so you cut out again at the end, but you were saying if you're going to replace the catheter, you want to think about what?
you want to think about changing as many variables as you can. So for example, changing who's replacing epidural, choosing a different level, choosing a different technique. So for example, if you use an epidural technique for your first block, maybe considering a dural puncture epidural or CSC, the replacement block, maybe prudent.
Okay, great. So, you know, one of the perennial questions that comes up, either from patients or from sometimes the obstetricians, is does anesthesia or analgesia technique affect labor? And this usually comes up with the question of, if I get an epidural, will that prolong my labor? But in general, does the analgesic technique that one might choose affect labor?
So, of course, the answer is yes and no.
As always.
We'll go no first.
Okay.
As always. So it's generally accepted that with the low doses of labor epidural infusions that women are using, that neuroaxial techniques don't increase the risk of cesarean delivery. An important factor to note is that women who are requesting neuroaxial analgesia, especially early in their labor, probably have something adherent to that patient that may have for things like this, a big fetus, a malrotated fetus, disproportion between the fetus and the pelvis or labor disease.
Okay.
So that may be the reason for C-section and not the epidural per se.
Okay, so our connection is not great, but I think what you were saying is that there may be something specific about women who end up needing a neuraxial technique, especially early, by which I assume you mean if someone has a lot of pain really early on, that may actually indicate
Correct.
That there's something going on. They may, for example, have a macrosomic fetus or a malposition, like we talked about, the upside down position, or there may be a cephalopelvic
Right.
disproportion. So there may be a reason they're having more pain, and therefore it would make it really hard to say if it was the epidural itself prolonging the labor or if it was the reason that the woman wanted the epidural in the first place.
Correct.
Okay. So you said it was yes and no. So what were the reasons why it might affect why the choice of technique might affect labor?
Great. So in terms of progression of the first phase, evidence in the that some of these that infected in all of may actually help speed up birth delivery.
So, Jackie, sorry, we don't have a good connection. Let's try
I'm
that.
So sorry.
Sorry. Let's try that one again. So let's see. So let's try again the kind of what are the reasons why it might have some effect on labor?
Okay. So, there is some evidence in otherwise healthy nulliparous moms that effective analgesia may speed up the first stage of labor, which again, it may be advantageous to some women, I can imagine.
Okay.
So that is the first stage. The second stage of labor actually increases by 15 to 20 minutes in women who use a neuraxial anesthetic. And this might be for a number of reasons, even just being the timing of the first stage of labor. So these women with epidurals may not be checked until way later on in their labor course, and that may alter basically how you measure the first stage of labor per se. But what we don't know is, even though it's increased by some time, 15 to 20 minutes, are there actual increased risk to the mom or the baby? And some of these risks may include things like chorionitis, perineal lacerations, and postpartum hemorrhage.
So I think what you Hello. The last thing you said there was that there's increased risk to the mom the potential increased risk to the mom and fetus are unclear. So chorioamnionitis, lacerations of the perineum, postpartum hemorrhage, we don't know if these are influenced. Is that right?
We don't know if these are significantly increased by this increase in the second stage of labor by 15 to 20 minutes.
Got it. Okay, perfect.
In people who use neuraxial.
Okay.
But what I did want to mention in this this last section here is that the ACOG doesn't have a time frame that after, you know, you're in the second stage for this amount of time, you know, you get a more invasive delivery plan. So that's important that they don't have a time designation sort of stamped on that for every single woman.
Okay.
And that probably should be individualized for each patient. And then lastly, in the yes category, in terms of vaginal deliveries, so analgesic techniques probably increases the decision-making tree of an OB to do an operative vaginal delivery. For example, if a woman is laboring and needs something like low forceps and you have an epidural, it might be an actually more favorable scenario to be in instead of needing forceps, not having an epidural, and then potentially choosing cesarean delivery over operative vaginal delivery. So it might influence the decision to do so, but it might be in the best interest of the patient and the baby as well to avoid an operative delivery, a C-section. So it's probably plus minus.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So while it may increase the rate of operative vaginal delivery, which means using forceps or the that suction
or vacuum.
Right.
Vacuum.
It may be that these women, if they didn't have an epidural, would actually go on to end up in C-section. But because they have the epidural, the obstetrician thinks, oh, well, you know, I can comfortably use forceps, so I'll go ahead and do that and avoid, actually, the cesarean delivery.
Exactly. In this, culture now where we're trying to avoid cesarean deliveries, operative deliveries might go up anyway. And having an epidural to make it more physically comfortable for the mom may be advantageous.
Okay, great. All right. So that sounds great. Are there other things that you want to make specific points on, or do you want to kind of sum up?
I think sum up is good.
So why don't you sum up for me what you really want people to take home from this podcast?
Great. So I think the first stage of labor, visceral, right, T10 to L1. Second stage, visceral plus somatic, so T10 to S4. That we do want to keep in mind that pain perception is complex. It's a relationship between physical and psychological factors, and not every woman is going to experience the same pain for the same labor pain stimulus. We do want to keep in mind that labor pain has some significant physiologic consequences, as we discussed, but an appropriate analgesic plan may favorably augment these physiologic consequences. Systemic medications like remifentanil and nitrous do have a role in modern-day obstetric anesthesia. However, they also have limitations and side effects, and these should be discussed with the patient ahead of time. Nerve anesthetics are still the mainstay. They have an added benefit of having a catheter in place in case the patient needs something like an emergency C-section. However, these do come with side effects as well, as we discussed, high spinal, local anesthetic toxicity, failure of the catheter. So these need to be... vigilance is needed either way. In terms of neuroaxial affecting the course of labor, again, if the answer is yes and no, no, meaning the C-section rate is not affected with low-dose infusions, but the second stage of labor is increased. Whether or not that causes additional harm is unclear, and that operative deliveries may be facilitated by neuroaxial anesthesia, so therefore those might be utilized more often in patients that have an epidural.
Great.
And I think that's it.
Jacqueline, thank you so much. That was fantastic, really helpful. And we'll also post some of the references you referred to on the show notes.
Yes,
But
absolutely.
Thanks for coming on again and for doing this podcast. We'll do another one soon.
Thank you.
All right. That's it, folks. Again, I apologize for the problem with the audio we had there. Hopefully everything got across. If there's any section that as you were listening you missed, or you felt like you just didn't get what she said and I did not catch it and follow up and summarize, go ahead and leave a comment on the website, acrac.com. That's ACCRAC.com. Ask your question and we'll make sure we get that information to you. Of course, you can always email me also at acrac@acrac.com. That's ACCRAC@ACCRAC.com. If you are a fan of the show, please take a minute to go to iTunes and consider leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. And as it turns out, even if you've already done it, it always helps to leave another one. So iTunes, even if there's a bulk of comments and ratings, if there haven't been any for a while, then shows start to drop down in the searches, and so it's harder for people to find this show. So if anyone's looking for a good anesthesia podcast, they might not see it quite as readily. So if you have time, even if you've already done, consider going to iTunes, leaving a comment and a rating, maybe just an update on the one you've left before, and that'll help with others finding the show. All right. You can also, of course, join the mailing list. That's acrac.com in the upper right-hand corner, where you can click there and sign up. I'll send around notifications when a new episode comes out and maybe something else fun every once in a while. If you are a fan of the show and feel like helping support the making of the show, consider going to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/acrac, patreon.com/acrac, where you can give even just a dollar or two to help support the making of the show. It really helps a lot, and we, of course, really appreciate it. All right, that's it for today. For Dr. Jacqueline Galvin and the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.